Good morning, everyone. This song was especially appropriate today because this was the favorite song of Swami Swahanandaji, and he couldn't sing, but he would recite it almost every, at least when he came to Tribhuvan after meditation, morning meditation. Every time he was there, he would recite this and Swamiji's hymn of Samadhi. And so he loved them very much. And of course, the author of this song, Swami Premeshanandaji, was Swami Swanandaji's father's boyhood friend and one of the great inspirations in the life of Swami Swanandaji. And today's talk, it's a Thanksgiving talk about giving thanks, but a lot of it will be giving thanks to the Guru, and in my case, to Swami Swanandaji. And we have with us a special guest, Dr. Maloy Das. Many of you know him either personally or through the book that he wrote, because he was Swami Swanandaji's doctor and very, very close disciple, devotee, traveled with him in many places, a great supporter of all of his work. He wrote a very beautiful book of his personal reminiscences with Swami Swanandaji, and now working on a second book with reminiscences of other people. So he'll be editing this book, and we actually have a sign-up sheet outside and some guidelines that we're going to be requesting all of you who knew Swamiji personally to write something and contribute to the book. And at the end of my talk, which I hope I'll finish a little bit early, we will invite Dr. Das to address all of you and explain a little bit more about all of this. So this Thursday, we will be having our Thanksgiving celebration. Those of you who don't have family or any place to go or simply want to come here are welcome to come here. We will have our Thanksgiving meal at noon this year. Yeah, rather than nighttime. So it'll be a lunchtime meal, and those who would like to bring something, you can bring a pie or a dish or something like that, but main food will be here. It's not a whole potluck thing. So everyone is invited for that. Thanksgiving. This is an unusual holiday. It's probably the only one that is more or less a religious holiday, but completely non-sectarian. And everyone celebrates it, and it can be celebrated even if you're not at all religious, because we all have reason to be thankful, whether it's thank God for this or whether we thank our friends or parents or relatives. It's an opportunity to express our gratitude for everything that we've been given in life, everything we've received without working for or asking for. Some things we have worked for and asked for, but it's a very nice holiday, and I think that it plays a very important role in our lives and spiritual life, this need to express gratitude, this need to express thankfulness. I just learned something just before I came here, that there's something called a gratitude list. Yeah, it's a very nice idea. It never occurred to me. We have this thing of counting your blessings and things that we're grateful for and everything, to sit down sometime and just make a list of all of the things that we're thankful for. It's a very nice idea. So I would like to suggest that there's something, some type of need that we all feel to express our gratitude and thanks, kind of an existential need almost. And if we look at many of the ancient traditions, the early seeds of religion came from this idea that we've received so much from nature and from ancestors and everything, that we have some type of obligation or duty to give back. But more than obligation or duty, we have a desire that it'll fulfill us somehow if we can repay this debt. So there's something within the heart, I think, of all of us that can get fulfilled with this practice. And it shouldn't be once a year, Thanksgiving. We can try to cultivate this attitude throughout the year. And it can become a spiritual practice, this idea of thankfulness. So we see it with many what we call so-called primitive traditions, which were not at all primitive. Many of them were actually very sophisticated, that the rains fall from the sky and the sun is shining and we get receive so much from nature. It's this need to give back to nature. This was the whole idea behind yajna in the very early days, this cosmic idea that we're receiving so much from all the gods and goddesses, which are really the forces of nature, that we nourish them and they nourish us. There's a long section in the Gita about this. We find that there's a tradition also of offering five different types of yajna. This is sometimes called the Mahayajna or the Pancha Virina doctrine, that we owe a debt to the rishis, to the ancestors, to the gods and the goddesses, to guests and to all living beings. So we have our way of giving back directly and indirectly. This is a very nice idea. If we have a debt to our parents for raising us and for taking care of us when we were helpless infants, we repay that debt not only by looking after our parents, but by doing the same thing for our own children. Okay? To repay the debt to teachers, not only do we honor them, but we try to pass on that knowledge. So in each instance, we see that there are different ways to give back. We give back to the earth. We have to be respectful of the earth. We receive so much from it. So it's a very nice idea that these things that we're doing, we give something in charity to someone else, is not charity. That this is our way of expressing gratefulness for what people have done for us. So there's no idea at all that we should feel proud or that we should feel the duty and obligation. It should be a privilege. We should feel the privilege to be able to do whatever little we can do as our way of expressing gratitude and thankfulness. There's a Gita is very strong with this idea that those who don't do this, those who simply lead a selfish life, always receiving, they're eating sin. They're stealing. They're like thieves. So this is part of this cosmic wheel. This dharma is kept alive through this process of receiving and giving. We have to do both of these things. Now, what are the things that we should be grateful for? If we think about our list, our gratitude list, we have on the one side material things and on the other side spiritual things. Should we only be grateful for the spiritual things? No, we can feel gratitude for everything. That whatever we've been given in this life, whatever things we've earned, whatever material possessions we have, whatever success we've had in our field, in our careers, family life, we should feel tremendous gratitude for all of that. So this is on the one side. Of course, we look at the spiritual side as being even more important. So from that side, we should feel this gratitude for all of the little instances of grace that have come to us. For a holy company, for we stumble upon some book that inspires us, all different things that will happen, for having the center here, having all the devotees here and everything. These are all things that we can be grateful for. We have a famous verse that's very, very often cited from the Vivek Chudamani that will specifically mention three different things. Dorlabham Trayam Evaitat Devanugraha Hetukam Manushatvam Mumukshatvam Mahapurusha Samsraya. That these are considered to be three very rare things that only come through divine grace. Three things that are very rare. The first is human birth. The second is this longing for freedom or liberation. And the third is taking refuge in a great soul. So we can say the role of the guru and all of the other spiritual teachers. And really, gurujan, this also means anybody who has played a significant role in our lives. This can be our parents, our elders, anyone, whoever we feel has been instrumental in helping us in life. We owe them a debt of gratitude as well. So I want to briefly go through all of these things. This manushatvam, human birth, I'm going to save that till a little bit later. Mamukshutvam, the desire for liberation or freedom or realization, however we look upon it. This is a very mild way of what Sri Ramakrishna used to call this vyakulata. This is a very mild form. When it says this desire for liberation, we can take it as a real longing. Something awakens within us. There's tremendous longing to have some type of higher realization, or to shake off this feeling that we're living with a covering of ignorance. It can be, in a very personal way, Sri Ramakrishna's longing for a vision of the Divine Mother. We'll see in the life of Buddha, it was in a very impersonal way. Tremendous desire to find out what is the truth, what is the point of this life. So we see that, and of course the great soul, that these three things are tremendously important in our lives. Now, the verse says that these are all due to the grace of God. So we get this concept of grace, which we know from a more of a Western point of view, it has one connotation. Sri Ramakrishna accepts that. He has a different interpretation also of this idea of grace. In many Western traditions, grace is something that is essentially unmerited. This is one of the main features of it, is that we haven't done anything that can explain why we've received that grace. So it'll be mercy, not merit. This is one of the definitions that we find. And on one level, grace is the opposite of karma. Karma, everything that we get, we earned and we deserve. It's through our own effort, whatever good deeds we did, that we'll get something good in return. This is something a little bit greater than that. We may have done some good things, but what we receive is far greater than what we've done to earn it. We can't imagine what we could have done that would bring so much grace into our lives. So we have that idea with this grace. Now we find in Sri Ramakrishna that he gives us a concept of grace that is universal, and it's open to everyone. The other concept of grace, it's a little bit, I don't want to say accidental, but we can't really predict who will receive this grace. It's a little bit up to the fickle mind of God, who God wants to choose to have this type of grace. But we can't really explain it. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, of course, gives the example of raising the sail and catching the breeze. That means that grace is open to everyone, that all we have to do is prepare ourselves for it, that it's that breeze of grace is always flowing, is always there. And we have that beautiful line from the song, Rupa Shaire. It was through the breeze of grace that the divine incarnation takes birth also. A very nice idea there. But even with this idea of grace, we'll see that those who receive it will still feel that, no, whatever I did, what did I do? I rowed the boat out to the middle of the lake. I raised the sail. That none of that is equal to the grace of simply leaning back and letting the breeze take it the whole way to the other shore. So that will also be there. Now, we find one other interesting thing, that in this Vedantic tradition, according to Sri Ramakrishna, there are two types of grace. One is preliminary, and the other is ultimate. So the preliminary grace will be really the three things that we mentioned earlier, that before the ultimate grace will be God realization. Before we get that, then this preliminary grace will be this human birth, this longing for liberation, and finding a spiritual guide for us. So we have a very nice illustration that Sri Ramakrishna gives, that there's a king who's he has a very small, ordinary type of kingdom. People aren't very wealthy. They lead a hard life. They're good people and everything. One day he says to his minister, I'd like to visit one of the families in the kingdom. So the minister says, okay, then we'll pick out one family. So they decide one family. And then he says to the king, they'll be highly embarrassed. They won't be able to accept you if you come to their house. And if there's nothing to offer you, if the house is in disrepair, if they have no tea set, no this and no that. So let me go first and make arrangements. So the king says, okay. So the minister goes and he tells the family that the king is going to come. So now this mamukshatvam comes. Then they think, this tremendous longing. The king will come. We'll enter into our house. So this is the first thing. Then the minister says, I see that this is broken and this needs cleaning and everything. We'll bring in a whole crew. We'll clean everything. So the house is spick and span. So this purity of heart has to come first. Then he says, now we want to give you a nice table and a chair and a tea set and all of this so you can serve him nicely. You have to have all of these things. That means we have to have devotion and love and dispassion and discrimination, all of these spiritual qualities. So they have to come. This is all the initial type of grace. Once everything is done, then the king comes. And that's the ultimate grace. So what we're talking about now is that grace which precedes this ultimate grace. And through God's grace, we hope that we'll finally get that experience. But we'll find that even if the king doesn't come, now we have a beautiful house. It's spick and span. We have all the nice things in it. So even that is a tremendous blessing for us. Okay, mumukshutvam. So this longing for liberation. I don't like this idea of liberation. That some people think, let me not be born again. This world is so horrible. Let me end all of this. It doesn't mean that. It means that there's something deep within the heart that says, no, there's more to life. There's something that, some purpose, there's some reason why we're striving for something. We may not know what it is. It may be a real devotional longing for some vision of God. It may be a highly impersonal idea, but it's something that becomes very, very strong. And unless we have that in spiritual life, we won't have any incentive. We won't have an incentive to do our spiritual practice. There'll be nothing pulling us away from the world, which is trying to trap us in all the enjoyments and pleasures and everything. So this has to be something that's quite strong. And it just comes upon us. That's why it's grace. It may be that we get some blows in the world. It may be some tragedy comes. It may be that we meet a holy person, but for some reason it comes upon us. It's very interesting in the life of Buddha, we have all of these things, that he had to see that there is sickness, there is disease, there is death, there is old age, all of that, and he had to see a holy person. So he saw all of those, and at the same time, this tremendous yearning of the heart came to solve the secret of life. What is this life all about? Swami gives a very beautiful quote. This is from his lecture on Maya and Freedom in his Jnana Yoga. He says, he alone can be religious who dares say, as the mighty Buddha once said under the Bo tree, when this idea of practicality appeared before him and he saw that it was nonsense and yet could not find a way out, when the temptation came to him to give up his search after truth, to go back to the world and live the old life of fraud, calling things by wrong names, telling lies to oneself and to everybody. He, the giant, conquered it and said, death is better than a vegetating, ignorant life. It is better to die on the battlefield than to live a life of defeat. This is the basis of religion. When a person takes this stand, he is on the way to find the truth. He is on the way to God. That determination must be the first impulse towards becoming religious. This is mumukshutvam. So this came to Buddha. He had a beautiful young wife. He had a palace. He had absolutely everything that he could possibly want. And still, this grace came to him in the form of these four visions that he had. And because of that, this tremendous longing came, tremendous desire to renounce, to give up everything. And of course, he left his kingdom. And through long years of hard practice, had that ultimate realization. We see that this grace can come in all different forms. We have the story of Wilhelm Engel, that he fell in love with a prostitute. And it was the prostitute who said to him, "Look, you're so attached to me. If you had just a tiny bit of that attachment to God, you could realize God." That was enough. So he used to say, "I bow down to this Chintamani as my guru." So we see these things are very closely related. If we get this tremendous longing for God, then we find that the guru will come, that some teachers will come, and we'll get some help for all of this. For most of us, it's not so dramatic as any of this. That somehow somebody tells us that there's a center here, that you can meet this Swami, why not read this book? Something will happen. And we'll later look back upon that and say, "Ah, this is the divine grace. This was the hand of God. Something happened. Why did it happen? I don't know. I walked into a bookstore in India many years ago. I could have picked any book. Somehow I picked the teachings of Swami Vivekananda. Who knows?" So we look back on these instances, and with our romantic mind, we say it was God's grace, something like that. So we all have this experience. There's something that makes us feel that this world is not everything, that there's something more to life, and we want to strive for that realization. So I want to look at this other idea. So we'll get to the second type of grace, this taking refuge in a great soul. Now, we all know that if we find a spiritual guide, we find it in Guru, that we consider that almost the highest type of grace possible, because this is the key. This is where we really, we're handed the chain, and that's attached to the treasure, hidden treasure. We have it. It's in our hand. Now it's up to us. We go link by link by link by link, and we get it. But otherwise, we're just diving aimlessly in the ocean. We're guessing maybe there's buried treasure here or there. But now we've been given that. So there's a tremendous type of grace that comes when we have the blessings of a great teacher that way. So I know we all feel that. Now, manushyatvam, this traditionally is interpreted as meaning that we have the human birth. We see of all the living creatures, there are so many more non-humans than there are humans. I read somewhere, I don't remember, something mosquitoes, how there are 1,000 times more mosquitoes in this world than people or something. That you go to Calcutta and you believe it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's very rare to be born, to have this human birth, just by numbers that way. But I want to look at it from a different point of view. What is it that's unique about this human birth? There are several things. One, of course, is that we have a little bit of intelligence, not much, a little bit of intelligence to analyze things and think things through. We have a little bit of free will. There's a big topic, I'm not going to go into it, but we have to at least feel, whether ultimately it's true or not, we have to feel that we have enough free will that we can make decisions, that we can choose, that we can see that, on the one hand, this will be nice to have, this will be enjoyable, this is prayas. On the other hand, no, this can lead me to something higher. We all feel that deep down. This idea of free will, to me, is more an experiential thing. Not analyzing all of these different theories, God dwelling within the heart, Divine Mother, they're all very nice theories. But when we go to do something, deep down we feel that, yes, I'm responsible for this. If we ever tell a lie, do we ever tell a lie without knowing that we're telling a lie and that we know that we really could tell the truth, but really I have to own it. I have to own it. I chose to do this, that I could have just told the truth. So anyhow, we have this little bit of free will. But the other thing is that we have our humanness. That means we have our weaknesses, that we have all of the qualities that are appealing to us. What appeals to us in other people? That they're not perfect, right? That they have their struggles. They have their moments of depression, their moments of doubt. We all have these things. These are all part of what it means to be a human being. There's a very beautiful poem, and I can never find it. If anybody knows it, it's a very beautiful poem that says, "A man is greater than the angels and worse than a beast." It's a very nice poem. That these beasts, they won't kill themselves, they won't do all of this. On the other hand, that greater than an angel and the kindness that we can show to other people. And so this human birth is a very unusual type of thing. Swami Vivekananda, he loved everything about this human birth. He once said that he'd fallen in love with man. And for him, it wasn't simply, the divine dwells within all beings. He loved each and every human being with all of their warts and all of their difficulties and problems and good qualities, bad qualities, everything. So what was the God that he loved? The poor, the distressed, those who were suffering. So this human element is something which is so beautiful in human nature. One of my favorite quotes, this is from a letter that Swamiji wrote to Josephine McLeod. "I'm glad I was born, glad I suffered so, glad I did make big blunders, glad to enter peace," because these blunders are what take us higher. We all have to go through all of these things. "I leave none bound, I take no bonds. Whether this body will fall and release me, or I enter into freedom in the body, the old man is gone, gone forever, never to come back again. The guide, the guru, the leader, the teacher has passed away. The boy, the student, the servant is left behind. Behind my work was ambition. Behind my love was personality. Behind my purity was fear." Of course, he's over-exaggerating. "Behind my guidance, the thirst of power. Now they are vanishing and I drift." So when we look back on our lives, we see that very often it was the mistakes that we made. It was the false pride that we had. All of the things that led us to suffer that become the greatest help in our spiritual life. And so we should be grateful for all of the problems and all of this, even our enemies, those who have caused the most problems for us, because we learn from all of these things. So these are all different areas where we can really feel some special gratitude. And the gratitude to me is simply a recognition of grace, how grace comes into our lives. So what I want to suggest is that we try to look upon this a feeling of thankfulness as a spiritual practice. We heard last week from Swami Sarvadevanandaji that contentment is also a spiritual practice. It's not that we try to do all sorts of things so that we can be content. We practice contentment with whatever we have. So this thankfulness, it's a spiritual attitude. And it relieves us from all sorts of frustrations and doubts and this tendency to see negative things, a very positive way of looking at things. Have a gratitude list, right? To see all of the things that we're grateful for, a very wonderful thing. So for me, I think we start with everything. We look at parents, how much we learn from our parents, how much they sacrifice for us. So tremendous gratitude for parents. For friends, this may not seem like a spiritual list, but how valuable is true friendship? And rare, it's very rare, but how valuable is true friendship? Those who are willing to do anything for us, to sacrifice for us. And so these are all tremendous things, and they give this feeling of grace. We can be grateful for the center that we have here. Yeah? We can be grateful for Thakur Maha Swamiji, that we were born so close to them in time, that we have such availability to their teachings, to their direct words, to their photographs, to their disciples and disciples, and how close we are to that tradition. And holy company, that we have this very rare and very, very valuable access to some of the most wonderful souls that we can imagine. Some of our senior swamis that come here from time to time and visit, we see that just how transformed they become. And this is something that really, in spiritual life, we don't get this in any other way. We don't get this through reading books. We don't get this through our own meditation. We don't get this through any intellectual type of thinking. There's a holy company. There's a reason why Sri Ramakrishna always points to holy company as the number one thing, that we get something direct, that this spirituality is something that is really directly passed on, lighting one candle with another candle. We see before us a living example of a transformed life. And it doesn't have to be a God-realized soul. These are God-realized souls. First of all, we can't judge. We don't know who has the ultimate experience and who doesn't. But if we see that transformation, if we see the purity of that life, if we see the love and compassion and selflessness, then this convinces us of several things. One, that it can be done, that this is possible. Two, that it's a joyful life. Sometimes we think that we have to go through tremendous sacrifice and suffering to have some higher type of realization. We see that no, the more we do spiritual practice, the more we progress in spiritual life, the more joyful it becomes. So we see this directly, that we see that a life based on a high spiritual ideal is the most joyful type of life, that the unselfish life is the best type of life. We see all of this directly. This is our inspiration, and this is the reason why this holy company and the company of these great souls is so very, very important. And we see how these great souls, the ability they have to love everyone without any preconditions. Our love always has a little bit of a tinge of selfishness to it, an ego that prevents us from freely loving. When they're free from that, from this ego, from this selfishness, then we see that love, it just flows. So this is really, to me, the highest type of grace, the grace of the guru, the grace of these great holy people, the grace of Thakur Maha Swamiji, all of the direct disciples. This is what tells us that, yes, it's real, it's true, it can be accomplished, and if we accomplish it, then our lives will be blessed. So this is my spiel for today. I wish all of you a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope that some of you will be able to come and join us. And I want to leave a little extra time and invite Dr. Das to come and to address all of us. I've known him for many years. He's very, very, a very sincere, dedicated person. And we're so grateful for all of the service he did for Swami Swahanandaji. So I will invite Dr. Das to come, please.
Good morning. Thank you to our Swami Atmaganandaji and the Swami Brahmarupanandaji and the other monks and Swami Swanandaji's devotees, friends, that it's my really a privilege. I'm blessed to be here on this platform to speak about something about a very special man, a special soul, not just for me, for many, many people. And I was supposed to be here 2.5 years ago, but things happened after releasing the book. Personal level, I couldn't make it. But finally, I'm glad that I made it. The whole idea of the book that this the man that we are going to talk is a young boy first. He was less than 15 years old when he used to commit to the mission in his hometown, and he was connected with some of the direct disciples at the Belur Mot. And then when he was 14 and a half, he used to communicate with Swami Akhundanandaji, and he wanted to be initiated from him. But it was a February 6th, 1938, that 1936, it was the last letter that he received, and he says, "Bipad Bhanjan, keep studying and think about the Thakur." And the last word he said, "Love God with all you have, and whatever good for you will come automatically to your life." And he took that vow, and he struggled all throughout life. I'm going a little bit backwards, then I'll come forwards, because I can't resist that word, because the first book belongs to that. And then, like Swami Vivekananda picked up one idea and keep on with that ideas. And he struggled that ideas. He had some good days, bad days. When he was doing the second master's in Calcutta University, he has some bacillary dysentery, very bad. And he said, "I want to die." Then after 2 days, he says, "Oh, I'm good. Then I don't have to." So he was very sarcastic. But the last word that we were on Austin, that was his last private center he inaugurated, and that was the October 13th, 2012. So 14 and a half years. This was his lecture, word by word, that I'm glad that I'm here. I couldn't have met if I would come afterwards, but I'm glad to see the center. But I can see the center the many, many years to come, because his vision was vast, past. We cannot think about that. Then he mentioned that I took a vow and I stick to on my vow to love God with all you have, and automatically whatever good for you will come. And I stick to it. It is not easy. At times it was very difficult, but I made it, and I'm glad that I stuck to it. Now I'm free. Actually, he mentioned several times about the Jivan Mukta at that time. So this is a man that who went through the whole journey. So he was just a man, then he became a brahmachari, then he became a sannyas, then he became a guru. He was a great father, and ultimately he was a realized soul. So the first book, actually, the book came, a little bit history will help, in August 2011, and so many things happened. I was very close to him at that time from the sickness and the private centers and everything. So I was really very emotional at that day, and I was in his room. I says, "Maharaj, I feel like writing something about you." And he looked at me and he said, "Why don't you do that?" Then I kept quiet. I didn't say anything. After 6 weeks, I went back, and I thought he forgot. He said, "Have you thought about it?" I said, "Yeah, I thought about it, but, you know, some of the people are saying that when the guru is alive, you don't write. I gave you the permission. What is the problem with that?" So this is how. Then I said, "Oh, my God, this is a big." I said, "Okay, I'll try my best." He said, "Yes, keep on going." But after that, he became sick, but things waited up to 2012. And so this is after his demise. Then I felt like that I should. But I, you know, his feelings was like a unity. He would never think of individual. He was like a Lord Krishna, you know. I mean, he looked at all the gopis, and the gopis thinks, "Oh, he loves, Krishna loves me more. Krishna loves me more." Same thing with Swami Swanandha. You go one by one. I was with him. Toronto, and every family goes, he says, "Oh, he just loves us so much." And the next family says, "He likes us so much." This is Swami Swanandha. He was unity. He's not just the one-sided or one-pointed, you know. It was tremendous. So I started writing the book, and it ended up with almost 400 pages. So the I started getting some reminiscences at that time. So the editor said he can't do that. So he cut down the half of the book, 50%. He knocked it out. So the 50% of the book published, but now I am obligated to complete the book because that was a one-sided of the office life. That from my perspective, and now everyone who came very close to Swami Swanandaji can easily write a book like this book, because he has this so much compassion, love, and everything, everybody. So I'm trying to do the second volume, which will be reminiscences of Swami Swanandaji, because I, at that time I received so many reminiscences, but I couldn't complete. That way that everybody should write their reminiscences. It's not big things. I have a pamphlet there. It's easy, like when did you first meet him? And what was your that impression after you came out of this room? If you are a disciple, what makes you think to get initiation from him? So things about that, write in simple language and everything. I have a great editor, and she will edit. The reason that it will be actually not the guru, because she has done so much for us, like Swami just told, that he gave us the activated password. We all have our username. So because whatever Malay Ardas MD @yahoo.com, but we didn't have the password. Now they gave us the activated password. So the password, we can make the contact, communication, relationship, and response. And the Wi-Fi is working, which we don't get to see. We run the computer, but we can't see the Wi-Fi. But Wi-Fi can connect us wherever we want to be connected. So the divine forces, divine everything, they can connect it through the activated password, which exactly the Swami said, and then we can achieve. So Swami Swanandaji, I have seen, I was very fortunate. It is his grace that he picked me from out of these people to write about this book. Through the whole journey, he actually supplied all the material. I didn't do honest. It's not the book. To be honest to the Lord, in front of the Thakur, I'm saying he has finished the whole book himself. I was just an instrument-like. So it was a wonderful journey, like, coming to the didactic lecture, coming to the retreat, you can never have God realization. Swami was telling last night too, that every lecture you go, you pick one or two ideas and live on to that and practice. So Swami Swanandaji, that what he did throughout the whole journey from the first day to the last day that he took one and the realized soul, and how he made the practical application of the four yogas of the Gita, that is in this book, that the practical application. I have seen in Toronto, I have seen in Dallas, I have seen in Austin. Every place I saw that his love and the detachment, you have to see that. It took me 3 years, 4 years, 5 years to know that much love and the detachment that, and plus the selfless service. I was telling the other Swami, 6 weeks before his passing, I said, I was with him in the room, and I said, Maharaj, any last minute, any suggestions, any recommendation? He looked at me, he says, keep doing what you are doing. Service, service, service. These are the three words he said. So he left actually the blueprint on this, the first book, that which will help all of us to realize the God if we want to, because the spirituality is not taught. The spirituality is actually caught through the divine forces, through the Swamis, through the holy companies. And in this life, that if we want to, in Bengali we have the mantra sadhan kingba sharir patan. If you are really serious about that thing, one can be liberated. It's a very good blueprint on this book, at the first book. I'll just read one chapter and then I'll go to the second. One day, it was very interesting, and I noticed one day, years that I had become involved with Maharaj's medical care, I came to his room to take care of some health-related business. Some devotees are massaging his feet, Padusheva, by turns. His face was turned towards Thakur's picture above the mantle, and his lips were moving slightly. If you remember Swamiji's room, and he was sitting there, and the bed on the mantle, Thakur's face was there. I wonder if he was praying to the Thakur for the devotees or repeating his mantra. Suddenly he said, "It is time for all of you to leave because my doctor is here." So all these ladies got stuck. "We need to take care of some other business." The devotees immediately left the room. Normally when someone provides us service, we say thank you, but Maharaj did not thank them. As I reflected on this, I wondered if perhaps he did not thank them because he did not receive himself as receiving the service so much, directing to the service to the Thakur through them. So he didn't. So I shared this story during the Labor Day retreat in Hollywood 2009. Various devotees were asked to share stories about Swami Shivanandaji. After the event, some of us were gathered in the Maharaj's room. Someone asked him what he thought of my analysis. Maharaj laughed and simply said, "Jai Thakur." So then I was relieved because I thought he would be scolding me. After the other devotees left, I asked Maharaj, "Would you rather than I hadn't told that story?" He smiled broadly and gave a sweet laugh, but said nothing. I also, Maharaj, ability to relate each person individually. Even a group, it reminded me how Lord Krishna had a special look and smile for each gopis. Cowherd girls, such that every gopi thought, "Lord Krishna loves me more than anybody." However, Lord Krishna loves was free attachment. When he left Vrindavan to go to Mathura, the gopis and the people of Vrindavan were crying and tried to keep him from leaving, but Krishna knew that his destiny called him to go to Mathura, that the divine play, the Leela at Vrindavan was over. As he left the Vrindavan, never looked back. It was a very, very favorite word Swami Shivanandaji used to talk in his several lectures. I once asked him, "We householders will have some degrees of attachment as long as we live. How then can we ever be liberated?" Maharaj's answer was twofold. First, do your work of worship. As you develop the attitude that everything you do belongs to Thakur, detachment will naturally grow. Second, there will always be some degree of bondage, maybe 10 to 15% as long as you have a physical body. However, if you develop steady devotion to God, that bondage will dissolve when you leave our physical form. He also used to say, if you give everything to Thakur, then Mother promised Thakur will come to rescue at the last moment of your life. However, if you want God realization now, you have to work real hard. So this is the one part of the book. There's the whole book. It's a great blueprint for all of us that we should know. And the second part, the second volume that we're trying to do, which the reason I'm here, that we're collecting the reminiscences. I have the wonderful reminiscences from some of the greatest sadhus in India here. And so far I have that it will be a fantastic book. But I want, this is one of the greatest centers, Swami Shivanandaji has spent his time, and he loved his devotees and everything. So I left some the leaflets just like that, which will tell you that how did you first meet Swami Shivanandaji? What was your impression of him at the first meeting? Did you feel any way compelled to meet him again? What is your impression of him now? How long did you know Swami Shivanandaji? Were you initiated by him? If so, what motivated you to request initiation? Does anything in your life today remind you of him? Were there any special teachings he gave you which can share? Can you share any special events or occurrences connected with him? So any small and big letters would be very much appreciated, and also that if you have received any postcard, any letters, any special pictures, I have several from New Delhi, from London, and they're just wonderful, and that will come into the book. So it will be the reminiscences of the book, some other things. Our Swamiji is going to write from Bengali book to the English conversion, and it will be there, his personal contact with Akhandanandaji and Kali Maharaj and Premesh Maharaj. So that book could be, we're planning, we don't know that how that's going to be end up. But I request personally that all the devotees and the disciples that who met Swami Sharanandaji, I think this is a something that the like a Thanksgiving time, it's a giving him thanks, but his vastness, we all have to complete our duties, homage, and love with the highest love and shraddha, and that is the Guru Seva, and I call Guru Dakshina. The good thing that the Guru never takes anything, it will come back to you by 200%. Because we leave the body sooner or later, but this book will remain time eternal, time eternal. So I don't want to take too much time. It's okay, Manas. I don't want to take too much time, so I request that we can start our Atma Gyanandaji, that she will be there, and I spoke to Mrs. Shukla Chakraborty, and she will be in charge of collecting everything. We put a deadline, temporary deadline, on 31st December 2019, but if you extend a little bit, it will be fine, but please, please do it just for you, not for anything, because to my heart, the Swami Swanandaji was alive and still alive, because as we know, the Guru never dies. Guru always grows within ourselves. And I thank you, everybody, Swamis and Brahmacharis. Everybody is being so nice to me here. They have the great hospitality I'll never forget, and I thank you, everybody. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. I won't take too much time.